This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, December 2nd, 2004. I'm Monica Lopez, sitting in for Deepa Fernandez. With the omnibus spending bill poised to pass Congress, we continue to investigate some of the many hidden expenses and cuts. As the Ivory Coast situation continues to escalate, Senegal steps up to try and make peace. And as we continue our special series this week to mark World AIDS Day, today we visit Cuba and Uganda. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Ballots in Puerto Rico for the governorship are being recounted today. However, the method is hotly contested. After the November 2nd elections, there is still no clear winner. Exit polls and newspapers gave the nod to pro-state candidate Pedro Rosello Gonzalez. But Aníbal Acevedo Vila, who is in favor of keeping Puerto Rico a colony and is the candidate of the current governor's party, reportedly took a slight edge. The recount was stalled for 6 days after about 150 election workers walked off the job, protesting the way ballots were being handled. Puerto Rico's Supreme Court ordered the counting to continue, while a U.S. district court said disputed ballots should be set aside and reviewed by the court. A key rocket fuel chemical has been found in some foods, including those labeled as organic, according to findings by the Food and Drug Administration. With the D.C. Radio Co-op, Dolores Bernal reports.
High levels of the chemical known as perchlorate has been found in Maryland's organic milk, in Colorado's green leaf lettuce, and in bottled water in California and Texas. The chemical is the primary ingredient of solid rocket propellants and can disrupt hormone functions, impair children's development, and cause tumors. Ronnie Commons is the executive director of the Organic Consumers Association. He puts blame on large defense contractors that dump in or near waterways where water is used for irrigation.
This is an outrageous contamination of the American food supply. We've got to crack down on these several hundred arms manufacturers, defense contractors, and apply the same laws to their operations that supposedly all of industry has to abide by, which is these companies should not be allowed to use our public waters as their sewer.
Reporting from Washington, D.C., I'm Dolores Bernal for Free Speech Radio News.
Two major television networks are refusing to run an ad by a Christian denomination, calling it too controversial in its appeal for an all-inclusive church. Katie Murray has the story.
The ad is a part of the United Church of Christ's new broad identity campaign. It says that, like Jesus, the church seeks to welcome all people, regardless of ability, age, race, economic circumstance, or sexual orientation. CBS wrote, because this commercial touches on the exclusion of gay couples and other minority groups by other individuals and organizations, and the fact the executive branch has recently proposed a constitutional amendment to define marriage as a union between a man and a woman, this spot is unacceptable for broadcast on the CBS and UPN networks. NBC, the television network carrying Will and Grace, the first show with a leading gay character, declared the ad too controversial as well. The ad was accepted for air on a combination of broadcast and cable networks, including ABC Family, BET, Fox, TBS, and TNT, among others. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Katie Murray.
Philippine government officials confirmed today that another journalist has been killed in the country, now considered the second most dangerous place for journalists. Gurley Lee now reports from Manila.
In November alone, five journalists were killed in the Philippines, one while standing outside a popular and crowded shopping mall. Media groups have decried the killings as the worst form of censorship, with the targets often crusaders against crimes and corruption. According to the National Union of Journalists in the Philippines, more than 60 reporters have been killed in the country since democracy was restored in 1986. None of the murders have been resolved. Suspects include local officials, police officers, criminal syndicates, and rebels. The killings have made the Philippines one of the most dangerous places for journalists in the world, second only to Iraq, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. But the government disagrees. Press Secretary and Presidential Spokesman Ignacio Buñes says the government was determined to defend and protect press freedom. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gurley Linao in Manila.
Native Americans in South Dakota charge that state officials routinely violate the Indian Child Welfare Act. Jim Kent reports from Pierre, South Dakota.
Naomi Johnson says her Native grandchildren were taken by the state illegally. Johnson notes that ICWA guarantees Native children be placed within their families or tribes to ensure their culture isn't lost. Marge Tuhawk says the adoption of her grandchild into a non-Native home is just one example of the numerous instances of the state's failure to follow federal law.
It's just making us look like we can't do anything with our children.
Native and non-Native protesters traveled to South Dakota's state capitol to submit petitions to Governor Mike Rounds that call for a permanent auditor for the Department of Social Services and for the redirecting of federal funds into family preservation. The protesters are planning to visit Rounds again on December 14th when the Governor's Commission on the Indian Child Welfare Act will hold its last public hearing in the state. I'm Jim Kent in Pierre, South Dakota.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
If confirmed by the Senate, I look forward to advancing your rural agenda for the 21st century.
That was Nebraska Governor Mike Johanns, whom President Bush today announced as his pick to succeed Agriculture Secretary Ann Veneman. At his side, President Bush then reiterated his agriculture vision for the next 4 years.
We'll keep working to open new markets to America grain and beef and cotton and corn. We'll enforce trade laws to make sure other countries play by the rules. We will expand conservation programs to help farmers and to protect our soil and water and wildlife. We will stand behind family farmers by keeping taxes low and ensuring the federal death tax is repealed permanently.
U.S. farm policy, however, is under fire from many countries, both rich and poor, and from the WTO for tax breaks to U.S.-based businesses and for unfairly subsidizing U.S. farmers to the impoverishment of farmers worldwide. In 2001, Governor Johanns was named chairman of the 25-state Governors Ethanol Coalition that supports Bush's attempts to expand the use of corn-based fuel in the United States. Environmentalists criticize this fuel because its production is polluting. Meanwhile, the FBI raided the headquarters of the top pro-Israeli lobbying group in Washington, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, also known as AIPAC. The group was also served with a grand jury subpoena in an investigation of alleged Israeli spying within the Pentagon. Even with the investigation, the U.S. is still poised to give Israel $2.2 billion in military aid. The money is part of the $19 billion foreign operation bill that is part of the omnibus appropriation package that Congress will finalize next week. Mitch Jezerich has more on the foreign operations bill from Washington, D.C.
Israel, about the size of New Jersey, is set once again to receive over a tenth of all economic and military aid provided in the U.S. foreign operations measure that is stuck in the massive omnibus spending bill set to be passed on Monday. Israel is the largest recipient of such aid, with $2.2 billion in military aid and another $360 million in economic support for fiscal year 2005. The second largest recipient in U.S. aid is Egypt, with $1.3 billion in military grants and another $535 million in economic assistance.
The largest chunk of spending in the bill is probably concentrated on the Middle East, because between Israel and Egypt together are really locked in for about 28% of the total.
Jim Loeb has been covering U.S. foreign affairs for over 20 years. He is currently the Washington Bureau Chief of the Interpress Service.
The military aid is designed to maintain Israel's regional military superiority in a way that it can take on and defeat very quickly either one or more of its Arab neighbors or any combination thereof.
The foreign appropriation measure, for the first time, provides Pakistan with $300 million in military assistance for the White House's war on terror. In Africa, $75 million is slated to help build an African Union peacekeeping force to help defuse the civil conflict in the country of Sudan. The measure also contains $403 million in humanitarian aid to Sudan, much of which is targeted to the Darfur region. The U.S. does provide billions of dollars in humanitarian aid every year. The largest chunk this year will go to fight global HIV/AIDS. $2.3 billion mostly goes to sub-Sahara African and Asian countries. Aid, for the most part, does come with strings attached. Last year, the U.S. withheld military aid to countries that signed on to the International Criminal Court. And this year, the Foreign Operations Bill would do the same, but this time with economic assistance. Again, Jim Loeb.
This would go to countries like South Africa, for example, or Jordan, or Kenya, who are considered strategically important. We're essentially saying, if you don't promise to us that you will never hand over a U.S. national to the International Criminal Court, we're going to withhold that aid.
The bill also provides $441 million for parent planning programs internationally. However, such programs would be ineligible if they either perform abortions or provide education on such options. Also, the U.S. has earmarked $8 billion to increase pro-U.S. government broadcasting throughout the Middle East, with such networks as Al Hura, Radio Sawa, and Voice of America. The House of Representatives will likely vote on the measure on Monday. If no changes are made, it will then go to the President. Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News.
The UN mission in the Democratic Republic of Congo announced today that it has arrested some 100 people suspected to be Rwandan troops after an incursion across the border into eastern Congo. This comes as the Côte d'Ivoire crisis continues and various African nations are weighing in on potential ideas for a peaceful end to the conflict, sometimes with their own interest paramount. Senegal is particularly affected because of the high rates of immigration to the Côte d'Ivoire, where some 500,000 Senegalese nationals have lived since the early 70s. Speaking to Financial Times, Senegalese President Abdoulaye Wade suggested Ivorian elections should be postponed and a transitional government appointed. As Njaga Sek reports from Senegal, this declaration nearly triggered a diplomatic incident.
The Côte d'Ivoire crisis gained momentum when Ivorian troops bombed the French military base, claiming the lives of 9 French soldiers. In response, the French military destroyed 5 Ivorian aircraft, bringing the country to the brink of a civil war. Speaking to Financial Times last week, Senegalese President Abdoulaye Wade said, elections in Côte d'Ivoire should be postponed and transition government composed of technocrats appointed as political forces failed to restore peace and stability. The declaration nearly created diplomatic tensions as Ivorian press claimed President Wade contested their political leaders, mostly President Gbagbo. Said Nuru Gay, Senegalese political analyst, says President Wade only proposed a way out of crisis.
President Wade didn't say anything about dangerous. In summary, he proposed that President Gbagbo stay in power, which is important for the Ivorian nation, as he has been legitimate until now. He also proposed a government composed of technocrats to avoid interference of political interests and drawn daggers in state management.
Senegalese nationals maintain cultural and diplomatic ties to Côte d'Ivoire. Côte d'Ivoire joined the French West African Federation in 1904. Since the early 70s, some 500,000 Senegalese nationals currently reside in Côte d'Ivoire as tailors, joiners, mechanics, or traders. Currently, there are ECOWAS forces, mainly composed of Senegalese, to safeguard peace in the country. This may have created President Gbagbo's partisans' hatred towards Senegalese. Senegalese nationals believe President Gbagbo is responsible for the recent tension. Mamadou Lamine Sané is a Senegalese teacher.
I think that Gbagbo is responsible of all the situation in Ivory Coast. You see, there is an agreement they signed on Marcosis. But so far, Gbagbo refused to make the agreement comes true. He refused to be cooperative with the First Nouvelle, and then everything he's doing for his own interest. Okay, so I think that Gbagbo must accept to discuss with the First Nouvelle and try to find a solution.
Côte d'Ivoire is an economically strategic country in the region. It constitutes some 48% of the Economic and Monetary Union of West Africa. With the largest port of the sub-region, it opens countries like Mali and Burkina Faso to the Atlantic Ocean. West Africa has a history of wars and political unrest. Countries inherited borders from colonization as Europeans set frontiers to serve their economic interests. The Article 35 in the Ivorian Constitution, stating that only those born in Côte d'Ivoire of Ivorian-born parents can stand for election, disqualified Alassane Dramane Ouattara, the most prominent opposition force, a northerner, supposedly from Burkina Faso. Civil rights activists believe that ethnicity should never be taken into account in African constitutions. Emile Djeme, member of RADO, African Connection for Human Rights, contests.
Je pense qu'aujourd'hui, il y a de nouveaux types de conflits.
Today, there are new conflicts emerging in Africa that can, in the long run, disturb all that the nations have built for nearly 40 years. The ethnicity problem referred to is nonsense. It's unfortunate that intellectuals bring up such concepts when we believe we've already acquired enough experience. With all the development problems we face, it's an evasion to hide behind ethnic barriers to justify our limits.
The Peace and Security Council of the African Union, meeting in its 19th session, urged the government of Côte d'Ivoire and all the parties to ensure the safety and protection of all life and property. In Senegal, government and NGO representatives see the UN resolution as the only way out. In Senegal for FSIN, I'm Jagasek.
As we continue our special series this week in commemoration of International AIDS Day, today we begin our coverage in Havana. Cuba's campaign to eradicate HIV and AIDS was, from the outset, controversial as anyone testing HIV positive was confined to a sanatorium in the days when the method of the virus's transmission was unknown and isolation was deemed necessary. All blood supplies on the island were destroyed and screening imposed. Whatever one may think of the methods, they were very successful. Today, Cuba has one of the lowest infection rates on the planet. Our Havana correspondent Joseph Muti spoke to one of the very first people to be diagnosed HIV positive in Cuba.
International HIV/AIDS Day is widely commemorated in Cuba. On Monday night, an awards ceremony and concert took place in Havana, and various cultural events, including psychodramas, ballet, and theater, have been going on all week. One of the people most recognized by the community for her work in HIV/AIDS prevention is Maria Julia Fernandez, who was married to Cuba's first official AIDS case, patient number one. In 1986, her husband, Reinaldo, returned from military service in Angola, bringing with him the new virus. Maria Julia was soon infected.
I was diagnosed HIV positive in 1986, and it was as if I was going to die the next day. My son, what was I to do with my little son? I knew I was going to have to go to the sanitarium, and all I could do was cry and cry and isolate and marginalize myself, refusing to speak to anyone because of the perception that everyone had of AIDS, including myself. Was one of the end, of death, that it was all over.
Maria Julia spent 11 years in the sanatorium, 9 of them with her husband. In 1993, the country's AIDS program was modified to allow those wishing to leave the sanatorium to do so, but this was a big step to take for Maria Julia.
I felt protected by the sanatorium and hid behind it. But after my husband died in 1995, I decided, in the midst of an economic crisis, to leave and face society. Although there was no open rejection of me, one always knew people were speaking of you. But I matured and today defend myself with great dignity, having discovered that AIDS and death are by no means one and the same.
Maria Julia herself, in spite of living 18 years with HIV, takes no cocktail of medicines. She is healthy and very, very active, being, in fact, perhaps Cuba's most recognized HIV/AIDS activist and one of its principal volunteers in the country's National Center for the Prevention of HIV/AIDS and STIs. She has also, in no small way, been instrumental in changing the face of AIDS in Cuba.
We go out into the streets and interact with people, telling them to be careful, to protect themselves. We explain that it's not a question of finding the perfect partner nor of not making love, but rather personal responsibility. This has changed me. Today, I might still be that person of the past, quiet, never talking of sex, but I saw so much ignorance about HIV, AIDS, that I had to do something about it,
I formed a group of people living with HIV and AIDS and took part in various projects, including Cuba's Own Names Project. From there, I went to join the National Center, which was opened December 1st in 1998. I was one of the founders of the National AIDS Hotline. From there, we created mutual aid teams that worked within the communities to empower people living with HIV. This is where my strength lies, in helping my people.
Maria Julia left the stage at the awards presentation on Monday with an armful of flowers, medals, and certificates. The changes that this one woman has been able to achieve in attitude, in policy and outlook on HIV/AIDS in Cuba were acknowledged by a packed auditorium in a standing ovation. For Free Speech Radio in Havana, I'm Joseph Muti.
In Uganda, experts have been discussing strategies to employ in the fight against the quickly spreading HIV virus. The third Ugandan AIDS Partnership Forum coincided with World AIDS Day, and the theme this year was about protecting women and children against HIV. Joshua Kilimpa reports from Uganda.
At the third Uganda AIDS Forum, a three-phased approach known as ABC, short for abstinence, be faithful, or use a condom, was adopted. But this approach has come under scrutiny from health experts who are questioning the effectiveness of the approach in protecting women and children from being infected. In Uganda, about 70,000 people died of AIDS and another 75,000 were infected last year. Since 1983, over 1 million Ugandans have died of AIDS, with over 1 million living with the disease. Despite these statistics, Uganda's anti-AIDS campaign has been successful, with a decline of 13% to 4.1%. This year, women and girls were the theme for World AIDS Day, due to women and girls being more susceptible to HIV infection than boys and men. In sub-Saharan Africa, 3/5 of adults living with HIV are women. According to critics, even if a woman abstains from sex till marriage and remains faithful, she will still be at risk if she marries an HIV-positive man or if her husband has sex outside marriage. Dr. Lydia Mungerera is from the Uganda Forum of People Living with AIDS. She believes that all the components are important.
We should not separate A from B from C. My approach would be, if I meet a young child, I tell the child that abstain and delay your sex. There is no hurry. Because young children who are below, let's say 13, 14 years, probably telling them about abstinence, delayed sex would be the best for them. But then if you go to children who are in university or teenagers, they haven't abstained already. So what do you tell them? If you have one girlfriend, keep one girlfriend. If you have one boyfriend, keep one boyfriend. Now, if I meet them and they're already in a relationship, what do we tell them next? Use a condom. Protect yourself from infection.
Mark Starring, the United's Director for Eastern and Southern Africa, says the debate should shift from the ABC and center more on empowering the women to have a say on issues of sex.
I don't think it is a matter of A, B, or C. A, B, and C have proven to be effective in Uganda and many other countries, but they're not enough. More needs to be done. There needs to be more work to address issues of violence against women and girls. In the case of Uganda, more work perhaps up in the north. There needs to be more work done to address the roles and relationship between boys and girls, for boys and men to be more supportive of women, and also girls and women to sort of to be supported so that they can modify their negotiation of sex and relationship with men. ABC is not enough. More needs to be done, but ABC is an important core of it.
More efforts are going to be needed to progress against AIDS and new efforts given to addressing gender imbalances, especially in environments where women and children are more vulnerable to sexual abuse and exploitation due to ongoing armed conflicts. This is Joshua Chalimpa reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Uganda.
The Pacifica Radio Archives is currently holding their drive to raise funds to preserve historical voices of resistance. The archives contain rare recordings of interviews, speeches, and reports featuring some of the most compelling figures and events from the past 50 years. The day-long fund drive, named Preserving a Living History, highlights the archives' 47,000 recordings, many of which are in need of immediate preservation. From KPFK in Los Angeles, which houses the archives, Auda Bogado reports.
Here we go.
There's the ambient cooling of the cooling. This is the sound of tape being preserved.
Mark Torres, Brian DeShazer, and Addie Givens opened the door to what's known as the vault.
the freezing cold air-conditioned room where the Pacifica Radio Archives houses their collection. A few years ago, there were several leaks in the vault's air conditioner, one of many obstacles the archives has faced in the past years.
We've got to thank the listeners for giving us the money to fix the air conditioner, which I remember was something you guys really needed last time.
Right, and it was much more complicated than we thought it was. We thought it was one fix, we had one leak, but we ended up having five different leaks in five different parts of the air conditioner.
So here we are surrounded by tapes, boxes of tape, and each, they're on steel shelves, and each one of these has a number and some writing.
Sweet Honey in the Rock, McCoy Tyner.
We have Amiri Baraka.
The vault is massive. A quick tour of just one shelf reveals countless audio treasures from Audre Lorde to Lenny Bruce. Besides funding from charitable organizations and the Pacifica Foundation, the archives turns to its listeners once a year to help preserve these historical documents. Brian DeShazer is the archives director. He says that the fund drive is crucial to the protection of what they do.
As we sort of learn more about what we need to do with the archives and sort of identify significant recordings, we go search out extra funding. And, you know, one of the most important funding mechanisms is the listener support and our annual fund drive, so that people can actually connect with the voices and the material that we're trying to save, so that they can be a part of it and really participate in the preservation of this history that so many people would like to see repressed again or just erased.
The name of this year's fund drive is Preserving a Living History. Mark Torres has worked with Pacifica Radio for nearly 15 years. As the archive's senior producer, he says that it's important to preserve not only the voices of the past, but those from the present as well.
Life and what the people's history is as it occurs each and every moment is a dynamic event. And we wanted to emphasize that this collection, while it is great, and spans over 55 years, it's continually growing, it's breathing, it's living, and it grows with every passing event that takes place. And we want to make sure that not only the historic programs are preserved, but the voices that are spoken today will be preserved for future generations.
But in order to preserve it, the audio usually needs to be transferred to new tape stock and digitized. Eddie Givens is the chief archival consultant with the archives. She explains some of the very practical dilemmas that occur with old tape.
You know, it's all reel-to-reel tape. It's almost all reel-to-reel tape. And that has a lot of problems. The binding, the binder that has the magnetic material, you know, holding it on the tape, like, releases and everything crumbles sometimes and stretches and breaks. These are histories of voices that are very, very relevant and important, cultural voices and historic voices that are repressed or forgotten in history. And our job is to make sure that that history that the Pacifica Stations has created lives.
Some say that now more than ever, those historical voices are under attack. Manning Marable is a professor of history at Columbia University. He says that it's important to preserve the voices of resistance.
It's so important to support Pacifica at this crucial moment in American history. And support for the archives allows us to create an intellectual, political, and moral legacy that challenges structural racism, sexism, homophobia, and other forms of discrimination and inequality.
For more information, log on to www.pacificaradioarchives.org. From the Vault at the Archives, I'm Aura Bogado for Free Speech Radio News.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Filling in for Deepa Fernandez, I'm Monica Lopez.